Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have Georgia's so-called rave revolution. Thousands of young protesters swarmed Tbilisi streets as part of what they claim is their impromptu white noise movement that arose in response to the authorities' latest anti-drug raids against their city's most popular nightclubs last Friday. They allege that too many innocents were unnecessarily roughed up by police after they burst into 2 separate clubs and detained a total of 8 drug dealers, deciding for whatever reason afterwards that their only recourse was to stage large-scale protest afterwards that unmistakably utilized typical color revolution tactics such as dancing and partying in the streets. This observation hints at a level of pre-planned organization that kicked into action after the controversial trigger event of the Friday night anti-drug raids gave the youth a reason to go along with this mobilization, which they claim is to press for more liberal drug legislation, something that, coincidentally, dovetails with one of Soros's favorite causes. In any case, some of the protesters have now took to calling for the Prime Minister's resignation, showing just how swiftly so-called civil society gatherings can turn into regime change movements, regardless of the legitimacy or even logic behind their demands. Interestingly, the white noise movement arose almost immediately after the so-called Velvet Revolution in neighboring Armenia, suggesting a regional spillover effect of youth-driven civil society unrest. The present Georgian government, while closely allied with the West, has been warming up to more pragmatic relations with Russia over the past few years, and is pressing for fugitive former leader Saakashvili's extradition to face justice for corruption charges. So there's indeed a little noticed geopolitical driver behind this newfound regime change push. Also, it can't be overlooked that Azerbaijan might be the final target of this regional campaign. This strategically positioned country is rich in EU-destined natural resources, but has lately become a close Russian partner, something that scares the West to no end. Not only that, but it's also a crucial transit state for the North-South transport corridor linking Russia to India via Iran. Any serious unrest in this country, let alone an outright regime change, might disrupt its connectivity prospects and negatively impact on the emerging multipolar world order, which is why the Azerbaijani authorities must prepare themselves for what might be this regional protest movement's inevitable expansion inside their borders. According to Xinhua, China's Inner Mongolia region will be connected to the Islamic Republic by utilizing pre-existing rail routes through Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, a concept that was proven before with test runs but will now officially enter into service. It would be a stretch to describe this as a game-changing connectivity corridor when it's only going to be used for sunflower seed exports for the time being, but it's nevertheless a constructive development for deepening Chinese-Iranian economic relations following the U.S.'s withdrawal from the nuclear deal last week. More products can be traded between the 2 great powers along this route in the future, and providing a pressure valve to forthcoming American efforts to contain Iran. But more will have to be done in this direction if that's to sustainably remain the case. The full potential of this Chinese-Iranian rail route isn't being exploited because it depends on older infrastructure that avoids some of Central Asia's most populous and economically productive cities by hugging the peripheral borders of its Kazakh and Turkmen transit states. Instead, what's needed is for China to make progress on its reported plans from 2015 for pioneering a Central Asian high-speed rail route to Iran that passes through the centrally positioned and most populous regional country of Uzbekistan, which, while trailing in comparison to its much geographically larger northern neighbor's energy-driven economic success, has the most attractive real sector economic value by virtue of its younger and numerically greater population. No Chinese-Iranian rail corridor can therefore be strategically complete without including Uzbekistan, which is left out of the recently announced rail route. Third in our countdown is the U.S. and Pakistan imposing restrictions on the movement of one another's diplomats. The steady deterioration of relations between these two erstwhile longtime allies is continuing, with the latest political crisis between them that was sparked by the U.S.'s decision to limit the distance that Pakistani diplomats in D.C. could travel outside the city. Islamabad imposed reciprocal measures against American diplomats located anywhere in the country, and the situation has since remained frozen, but is nowhere near resolved. While American-Pakistani relations have been worsening for the past couple of years now, and especially since Trump's aggressive New Year's tweet against the country, they hit a low point when an American military attaché who had hit and killed a motorcyclist was originally forbidden from leaving the country aboard a U.S. military plane that had come to retrieve him last week. A Pakistani court had ruled that he didn't have full diplomatic immunity, but he nevertheless left the country on Monday under unclear circumstances. It was presumably the legal actions initially pursued against this diplomat that infuriated the U.S. to the point of wanting to humiliate all Pakistani diplomats in the American capital through the imposition of new travel restrictions. But Islamabad had a good reason for broadening its own reciprocal decree to include all American diplomats anywhere in the country. It was reported at the end of last month that the CIA failed in its secret plan to stage a jailbreak to free its local agent, who was accused of cooperating with American intelligence in its quest to kill bin Laden. And it's well known that U.S. diplomats sometimes clandestinely go beyond their official duties in running spies inside their host nation. That's probably what the Pakistanis are worried about after the news broke that the CIA was trying to organize a jailbreak, one which probably would have been violent and likely resulted in the deaths of some prison guards. All states have the sovereign right to implement what they claim to be national security requirements, whether they really are, like in the Pakistani case, or are just unbelievably said to be, like in the American one. But the reason why this political crisis in particular is so sensitive is because it involves the privilege of diplomatic immunity as established by the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, as well as the respect given to other countries' diplomats more broadly. In this instance, Pakistan was right to press for the American diplomat to be brought to justice for brazenly running a red light and killing a young man, even though he was eventually allowed to leave the country. While the U.S. is exploiting its now irrelevant response in order to humiliate all Pakistani diplomats in the American capital. Given the national security danger that American diplomats pose after the CIA's failed jailbreak plans, there's a legitimate reason why Pakistan's reciprocal response extends to all U.S. diplomats in the country. Nevertheless, it can be expected that the U.S. and its global mainstream media partners will reframe everything in the reverse by making the world think that the Pakistani victims are really the aggressors and that the Americans are completely innocent of any wrongdoing. This high-level intensification of the hybrid war on Pakistan is intended to damage its target's international reputation, but might counterproductively raise its soft power profile among its newfound multipolar partners, such as Russia, by proving the sincerity of the game-changing Eurasian geopolitical pivot that has recently commenced and which provoked the U.S.'s rage to begin with. Our runner-up is the geopolitical implications of last week's elections in Malaysia. Former longtime Prime Minister and nonagenarian Mahathir bin Mohamad returned to office after incumbent Najib Razak suffered a humiliating loss that many analysts attribute to the multi-billion dollar 1MDB corruption scandal that he's implicated in. A whistleblower leaked incriminating documents about this scam a couple of years ago that have since been used as the basis for the U.S. Department of Justice to launch a multi-continental criminal investigation into what really happened. Suffice to say, the ordinary problems of most Malaysians took on a qualitatively new character after they began to believe that their situations wouldn't be as bad had the government reinvested the billions of dollars it is accused of stealing into the economy like it originally promised it would through that fund. Naturally, the civil society anti-corruption campaign that emerged in the wake of this ended up unseating Najib and could even lead to formal charges against him now that he's no longer in power. Prime Minister Mahathir campaigned on a platform of investigating every deal that his predecessor signed, including Silk Road ones with China, such as the East Coast Rail Line. And this has led to concern that Kuala Lumpur might renege on some of these contracts on the pretext that they were agreed to on corrupt pretenses that don't serve Malaysia's true national interest. Some of the projects have indeed proven to be controversial, such as the aforementioned East Coast Rail Line that Prime Minister Mahathir railed against on the campaign trail. But irrespective of this particular project's ultimate fate, it's highly unlikely that Malaysia will become anti-Chinese because its latest and previously longest-serving leader has a proud multipolar track record. What the new government wants to do is restore a sense of balance to Malaysia's international economic relations that avoids any perceived, which is a key word here, over-reliance on China, especially after Trump pulled out of the US-led TPP that the country was signatory to during his first day in office. These steps to strike a multipolar middle ground that's neither anti-Chinese nor pro-American is an emerging trend among some countries that altogether points in the direction of creating a new non-aligned movement, or Neo-Nam, in the new Cold War to replace the presently existing but practically defunct one that was inherited from the old Cold War. This time around, however, instead of balancing between capitalism and communism, this third force would walk the line between the American-led and Chinese-led globalization models, picking and choosing the best project offered from each of them in order to acquire the most advantageous development portfolio for their specific national interests. For example, while the East Coast Rail Line veritably fulfills a long-term strategic significance and the grand sense of multipolarity by helping Chinese traders avoid a potentially U.S.-blockaded Strait of Malacca, the medium-term cost imposed on the Malaysian economy through loans and other means have understandably become a lightning rod of controversy in the country. It's for these reasons why Malaysia, under the returned leadership of Prime Minister Mahathir, is expected to remain multipolar, even if it changes the manner in which it was hitherto expressed this geostrategic vision by rebalancing its relations with China and the U.S. At our top spot, we've got the reason why Russia decided not to sell S-300 anti-air missiles to Syria. Russian presidential aide for military and technical cooperation, Vladimir Kozhin, revealed at the end of last week that his country would not be delivering this system to Syria because the latter, in his words, has everything it needs, which instantly sparked a flurry of furious reactions in social media from people who had convinced themselves that Russia just backstabbed Syria. That's not true at all, because even Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov clarified a few weeks ago that no decision had been made in this regard and that Russia was only signaling that the previous so-called moral obligation that it felt in not transferring these missiles to Syria was no longer a factor. Unfortunately, some people interpreted characteristically ambiguous and open-ended diplomatic statements according to their own confirmation bias in convincing themselves that these missiles were on their way, or in the most extreme case, according to some alt-media narratives, had already arrived. The latter train of thought is attributable to a Syrian official statement in this respect, although it was almost immediately denied by the Russians after it was made. It's unclear whether this pronouncement was an innocent error or part of what is typically called MILDEC, or military deception operations designed to confuse an adversary about one's military capabilities. In any case, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov confirmed that the shipment was not going through, but added that it had nothing to do with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to Moscow as President Putin's guest of honor during last week's Victory Day celebrations, like some people thought. This comment is very important because it indicates that the Kremlin made this decision independently of Israeli lobbying and before the Putin-Netanyahu summit, suggesting that it was due to Russia's strategy in balancing Syria, Israel, and Iran more so than any other factor. To back up this theory, it's enough to quote President Putin himself when he was speaking to Israeli media in 2005 and answering a question about why Russia didn't sell certain military equipment to Syria during that time. According to the Russian president, "We refuse this deal because we do not want to violate any bounds, however fragile it may be, that exist in the region," end quote. And it's conceivable that he retained this balancing vision into the present day. Unlike that, however, there wasn't ever officially any deal on the table for Russia to refuse because the previously quoted government sources stated that no such agreement even existed in the past month that the idea was bandied about. It was literally just that, an idea, and never anything more, no matter how much some people may have imagined otherwise, irrespective of the confusing signals that came out of Damascus. Alright folks, well there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend, and tune in again next week. Thanks, bye.